Okay, first of all, it is great to be back at NACL, and this is my first time officially in the new building, and it is a massive improvement over the previous place for a couple of reasons. First of all, I like the fact you have high ceilings. You make it feel like a very much more expansive place. Got nice windows. Although there is one challenge to this location. If you are going to try to attempt a diet, and you are literally cross street from a bagel place and a sushi place, it's a problem. And their nosh is way better than their bagels, just, you know, but you may have noticed that. It's not terrible, but their baked goods are actually very good. The other stuff is average. That's not an endorsement, I guess. Whatever. And the sushi's, all right, it's sushi. Anyway, so first of all, big thanks for Guy welcoming in. Again, just those who, Aaron, don't know. So I was his teacher back in 1992, and we've had a relationship since. And it's 25 years. Where did the time go? Don't know. Anyway, so the question I want to address today is, have we become our parents? So this is a question that, and there's a cute little video that I'll show you. Let's go to the videotape. I like to do this sometimes.
First, I thought it was just a stress of moving. Hey, who's using that?
Think we own stock in the electric company? I will turn this car around right now.
There's nobody back there.
I was becoming my father.
It's been an adjustment, but we're making it work. You know, Progressive.com makes it easy for us to get the right home insurance.
Progressive can't protect you from becoming your parents, but we can protect your home and auto.
All right. All right, so the question... Basic question, do people become their parents? Just a...
Yeah, sometimes.
So what would be the reason that you would say that they...
Everyone gets certain mannerisms from their parents.
Okay.
Or someone that thinks of their father as their hero, you know, they right. want to be just like them.
Right. All right, so there's a certain class of people that will look at their father as a heroic individual. I would say not most. Maybe some, average. I don't know. I don't have a sense.
I didn't mean it like heroic.
Right.
Like,
okay. Somebody can look up to.
Idol, yeah.
Right. Right. So, but is a person a Xerox of their parents?
No.
Okay. So why not?
Because I think everyone sees the good and bad in situations. So you try to tend to go to what you think is good in that person, whether it's your parent or somebody else.
Is it easy to evaluate your parents as, you know, the good or bad in them?
Is it easy?
Yeah.
No, I would say so.
Do you now, how conscious do you think people are of the trends that they have within themselves that really are from their parents? Is that an easy awareness?
No.
No. But you... When will you notice that you become like your parent? When will you have that catching moment?
When someone points it out.
Right. So it's typically someone says, you know, your dad would say the exact same way and the exact same thing, and would sit in that kind of way, and you were completely unaware of that. Right. So the thing is that, like this, that on one hand, that your parents, since you spend all your formative years typically with your parents, so therefore, certainly the genetic contribution of your parents, you got. I mean, that's... Those are the cards you dealt with. That's a given. And then your environment, you grew up with mom and dad. So you're, meanwhile, absorbing all these different things. So the truth is, it's very, very hard to, first of all, be aware of it because that's just your way of being. And also you go through different stages. Typically when you're a teenager, you look at your parents as being idiotic and foolish and stupid and, you know, I would do it much, much better. And then what happens as time goes on? What happens as time goes on? What happens when you start hitting your 20s? And certainly your 30s? How do you look at mom?
To come back.
Right.
I'm saying, like, first they're idiots.
Right.
And you're like, oh, right.
But why did your analysis change with them? Did they change? So what changed?
You just went through an evolution. That's all.
So what insight did you gain?
Life.
So
the world. So you realize that they are the way they are because the world is the way it is.
It's experience.
Right.
It's all experience.
Right. So, you saw from your limited teenage perspective that seems to be a foolish decision.
But you still realize the mistakes they made, sure. But you understand that they did their best.
Right. Okay, right. So there's two things. First of all, if they made mistakes, you understand the bigger context, right. So therefore you can give an adult understanding.
You have empathy.
Right. Right. Because typically, the empathy will kick in when you yourself have experienced a similar kind of challenge, and you know either you've been successful or unsuccessful in that struggle. So you say, you know something, I used to be very hard on my parents. I would indict my parents, feeling that they were weak or foolish or this or that. In reality, they were doing the best they can with the cards they were dealt with. So I'm a little more sympathetic. Or sometimes, as I felt that their decision was foolish, but now I see in the greater picture it actually was something that was deceptively smart. In other words, it seemed to be a dumb move, but then I see in greater context that was an intelligent move. In other words, you also build that out. So you start, as you get older and you start to live life, as you said, you start to appreciate some of the things they did which were intelligence.
Sometimes it doesn't.
And sometimes they see things that were not so smart. And again, but then if you get older, you become more sympathetic, because as you've gone through different life challenges and have had success and non-success, then you understand, like, you know, life is not so simple. Mm-hmm. And you're gonna be successful, and sometimes you're definitely not going to be successful, and you're going to make mistakes, you're going to act impulsively and make, you know, and that's going to be a big challenge. But here's a key thing, what I've noticed, and I'll say that basically the challenge of the influence of your parents is dramatic. And whatever they think, so not only insofar as tastes and sort of personal things, like, you know, they like certain kind of food, therefore you might tend to like that kind of food because that's the food you grew up with or not. But more importantly, but their values, what your mom and dad's values were, become typically, unless it's really reflected upon, defined as the good. Whatever mom and dad did, in the default setting, sort of the Times New Roman 12 setting in yourself, is that what mom and dad fundamentally did, unless it's tremendously egregious, is what? That's the good way of life. Because that's what you saw for the first 18 years of your life. You saw that in action. So that becomes absorbed. So, and how, now, the reality is, we, as you guys are adults, you know that mom and dad, you know, you have the good, you have the bad, you have the ugly. You have stuff that their values were on point on, and when you reflect upon it, you see how amazing it was. Then you see certain values that, not so good. But is that a self-awareness easy to come by?
It comes with maturity. It comes with life. It comes with age. It comes with your own regret. And it comes with reflection.
But is that easy to come to that awareness? Is that an awareness that's automatically, is it like, oh yeah, I understand that, you know, easily to categorize their whole...
Nothing's easy.
Without, because that is true.
There are triggers that cause this type of realization.
Right. All right, so it's not an automatic thing.
I don't think it's automatic. Right. I mean, things have to happen in life where you come to realization.
You have to become a parent to understand your
parents. Right, right. That's true.
Not necessarily true.
It's definitely true.
It's definitely true.
If you're not a father, you cannot understand your father.
Right. Correct. It's right.
100%.
Right.
End of,
so the reason of that is that when you've gone through the whole experiences and you feel the pressures and the tensions and the stress of raising kids and the responsibilities, then you start to understand, you know, why did Dad come home on certain days completely angry at the world? He understood that because he was, you know, stuck between...
Now you're going through that same experience.
Exactly.
You're suffering through the same right. part of my friend's right. shit. Your dad
right.
had to go through
right. But not at the knackle, because everything's good at the knackle. Other people. People out. The people outside that door. Everybody except for here, it is gun-aided. It's bliss. Just make those damn calls. Okay, so...
The sales, right.
No, right, not just calls. ABC.
Conversion.
Always be closing. Gentlemen. That's it. That was a paid plug. The Shear. Because you think it's a Shear. It's not a Shear. It's a sales inspiration. Anyway, so the key points like this, what I would like to argue is that fundamentally, so far as the values that mom and dad gave us, some are going to be outstanding, some are going to be less than outstanding, and sometimes only through triggers, events, either, you know, raising kids yourself, can you really put them on the table and dissect them thoughtfully to see if, are they good, are they not good? Let me give you a simple example. Like, you always notice, there's always people that have this sort of tendency, let's say they go to a hotel, they feel that they've bought, you know, they've rented the room for things, they feel a desire, even they don't need it, to take as much stuff from the hotel room, which
they own it.
Right, because apparently it was not a rental, apparently it was a purchase. So the towels are not going on the floor.
Anything not nailed down.
Right.
When you're walking out with the mattress,
you'll see something like bizarre, like it's like if you saw your parents or your mom, whatever, like have this sort of thing of like taking the towels home, packing the towels into the, you know, and you know that because when you go to the person's house, it has the name of a well-known chain on that. I don't know. Did we change our name in the house? Hilton, DoubleTree, Marriott. What's going on here? So the thing is like this: that in your own mind, objectively, that's no different than going into a supermarket and then taking stuff and putting it into your pockets. It's theft because they don't want you to take the towels. Pretty clear about that. But in your own mind, the default setting is that's not so bad because you saw mom do it. So automatically, unconsciously, that practice viewed as it's not so terrible.
Which one of your parents did that?
We don't have to out anybody.
Do the hourly hotels that you go to?
All right.
Too expensive. He goes by the quarter hour.
All right. Bring it back. So, or the people that like, you know, they go to Dunkin' Donuts and they feel that they view the condiment section as a personal visit to Costco. So like they're like you see like these people like they're taking like you know 300 Splendas, you know, because that small cup of coffee needs a little sweetener. Just in case the person didn't listen to me when I said 2 Splendas, so I got to take 300 into my bag just in case there was an error, right? So people look at that thing as like, I'm going to Costco. Clearly beyond the expectation of this, you know, so that would be technically theft because right. They have a certain expectation of giving out a certain amount, not the entire container, okay? But that person in their mind was trained as a child. They saw mom and dad, possibly, that's what they do. Or conversely, let's talk about a positive. Let's say you saw your parent always give charity. You know, he went to shul, he went to this. You just witnessed charity happening all the time. He didn't tell you, he didn't say, I'm now going to give charity. He didn't do that. He saw mom and dad acting in a charitable fashion. So that lesson is extremely powerful. Conversely, the child is likely to be naturally inclined to charitable because he saw that that becomes a value, becomes the unquestioned value. Now, you ask, well, why is being charitable a good? He may not necessarily even be able to give you a good argument. It's a good thing because it becomes a given. So the point of the matter is, that's why, so here's a key point. As parents, The term in Hebrew is mesora. Every parent, through any person on the globe, is giving a tradition to your. You're giving a tradition to your kid. Now the choice is very simple. Do you want to give a high quality tradition or a low quality tradition? Because your kids, they don't listen to what you're saying, but they do watch what you're doing.
It's not do as they do.
They don't hear. They don't. Right. You may notice that kids tend not to listen to you, but they have a radar to detect what you're doing and what your real values are. So they're absorbing. They're like sponges.
Even when you think they don't yes. see it.
You can't get. They don't leave. They're always around.
They're always around.
And they're watching you. And they're watching you on your good days. And they're definitely watching on your bad days. And that's the challenge of parenting because there's no, it's not like you can do a parenting performance. It's like all the time until they move out, which could be a long time. So the bottom line is that as a parent, you are always giving, you're always communicating your core values. Conversely, that child is absorbing it in an undifferentiated way, and it takes an act of work and will to try to dissect, is this good? Does this make sense? Does this not make sense? It's very hard. And typically people don't even do that until they're confronted. They absorb that value and then they see that it, you know, either doesn't make sense. They have a moment either by parenting or other life experiences where they have to really like, is this the intelligent way? Like, this is how mom and dad, like, you know, let's say classic way. Maybe you had parents that felt that, you know, For every infraction, what they call patch and punim, a smack across the face was the best method of discipline. Apparently, you may now think that, that's what mom and dad, and that will be your default wine to go right for the potch. That might be your initial thing, but then you might say, well, that might not be work. That may have worked in 1950, 1960, 1970, but in 2017 may not be the best use for this one.
I just found out recently that the things my parents did to me,
right?
I'd go to jail for it if I tried to do it.
Right.
Crazy.
All right. So with this
introduction.
No, but you can't hit a kid with a belt. These days, you hit a kid with a belt. If someone finds out, ACS takes your kid.
You were hit with a belt?
Yeah. You were never hit with a belt?
My
parents are Russian.
I was
brutal.
He was Russian.
Right. I will tell you, I too was hit with a belt. Yeah. As a, going back to the early 70s, because I was, a little mischievous kind of guy.
You were a kid.
I was a kid. I was a kid. Right. We'll talk about.
You don't have to get the belt.
No, did not have to get the belt.
My father would tell me he wanted me to eat fish. You want to know something? Case in point.
Go ahead.
Case in point. I will never bring this up.
But we're among friends.
Amazing. This is amazing. Listen, you want to talk about how they influence, how your parents influence you? This is unbelievable, right?
Go ahead.
So Shabbos, Friday night.
Right.
We're going to have challah.
Right.
Dip.
Right.
Fish. Nice. Soup. Chicken.
Sounds
salad.
Delicious. Well done.
All right. Come on over. To this day, right. Friday night, right. I will never eat past soup.
Okay.
Because I could never eat past soup when I was a kid.
Right.
And my father was to force me to sit at the table and finish a chicken. Right. And I would never finish a chicken because I couldn't finish a chicken because I wasn't hungry anymore.
Right.
But to this day, inherently, past on Friday night, I can't eat past soup.
Right, right. Right.
It's crazy.
Right. That's it.
Hey, that's where the milk comes in now. You don't eat what? You don't eat so good. You don't get the milk.
All right. So with this introduction, explain, I think, a fundamental question and a challenge that we get from this is the beginning of the fifth book of the Bible, Book of Devarim. And I just want to read a little bit. Anybody want to read, actually? Take from the first four verses, first sentences? Anybody? Any volunteers? Anybody
George,
a good reader?
Come on, Ben. George, come on, Ben. Oh, new guy.
Come on, Ben.
All right, we're not forcing anybody. That we're not going back to the way their parents would have handled that. You're going to read it, and you're going to read it now. All right. These are the words that Moshe spoke to all of Israel on the east bank of the Jordan in the desert and in the Arava near Suf in the vicinity of Paran, Tophel, Lavan, Chaseros, Dizahav. This is the area in which was an 11-day journey from Horeb in Kadesh Barnea on the way to the Seir Highlands. On the 11th, first of the 11th month of the 40th year, Moshe also spoke to the Israelites concerning all that God had spoken to command them to them. This is what he had defeated. This was after he had defeated Sihon, the king of the Amorites who lived in Heshbon, and Og, king of Bashan, who lived in Asheroth. Hud was defeated in Edrei. Moshe began to explain this law on the east bank of the Jordan in the land of Moab. So the opening sentence of the entire book, these are the words spoke to Moses, to all of Israel. It's sort of like what really is. It's unclear what he's saying. And then the second part of the thing is like it seems to be this list of random names of locations. So one possibility, this is he's giving a GPS location. It was in the east bank of the Jordan, in the desert. This could be viewed, one way is to view this as talking about a very precise location. But again, of course, that seems unnecessary. Why do we care? And Rashi, which I have over here, takes in a completely different direction. He takes the word devarim, words. These are words of rebuke. So really, Moshe is on the, he's 6 weeks from his death. The Jews people are parked basically in modern-day Jordan, opposite on the eastern side of the you have the Dead Sea, you have the mountains of Moab, and over on the other side that's where he is. So, not that far from Amman, that's where he is with the camp, he's not crossing. So he's got to give them this is his last will and test. These are his last lectures, if you will. So Rashi says these are words of rebuke. Okay. And Moshe enumerates here all the places where they angered the omnipresent. Therefore, he made no explicit mention of the incidents in which they transgressed, but merely alludes to them by mentioning the names of the places out of respect for Israel. So he says, based on the words, he looks at these are the words that Moshe spoke concerning these locations, not in the specific locations. But he didn't mention what occurred yet.
Right.
Okay, we're going to talk about certain things that happened in these places. Pause. Okay. First of all, the question is, I have a basic question. The transgression that occurred in these areas, the people that he's speaking to, were they involved in these transgressions?
No, those people were wiped out, aren't they?
Correct. These are the kids. So the question is, why would Moshe...
Don't follow your parents' transgressions. Make it habit.
But if you read the rest of Devarim, the first five chapters, he's speaking to them as if it's them.
Because you are your parents.
Well, the key challenge is, Moshe takes the assumption is that the values of your parents is so natural to you, and if the things that they stumbled and fall by, you have a high probability of following them and failing in the exact same way. So he speaks to them as if they're them. So really, the assumption is, have we become our parents? You will be your parent unless you actively, thoughtfully, reflectively examine what your life's about. It's not if you leave, let life go, you will be your parents. For good and for bad. You're just going to be you're going to be the ultimate DVD ending of your parents. Unless you, as an act of mind, an act of thoughtfulness, reflect carefully on that. So Moshe, the teacher, he's having what they call modern psychology. He's having an intervention. Because these guys were kids while these events happened, like the golden calf and the sin of the spies, various events. And basically the kids are waiting around for their parents to die. They want to have a life in Israel. They want to set up a new state, a new sovereignty. And they have to wait till their parents get off the stage. But so you think that they view themselves, well, I'm not going to be like mom and dad. How many times have we all said that? I'm not going to be like them. Moshe says, no. You're going to be like them. But we're going to now talk about what occurred. We're going to break it down. We're going to see their fundamental flaws. So it goes from the unconscious to the conscious. So it'll be right there. And then you have the challenge of, are you going to exert your free will to choose to do which was consciously the path of your parents or consciously the path of your new future? That was really what he was presenting them. And that's why he treats them as if they're them. Because basically, we are our parents insofar as core values unless we, as an act of thoughtfulness and an act of will, an act of decision, go the other direction. It is not a guarantee. And that's the assumption. If you don't assume that, then the whole conversation makes no sense. He's talking to them as if they're them. It's the 40th year. Those people are dead. They're gone. They're Jewish history. It's over. Over. So what's going on here? So that's what's happening. So he's speaking to them as if they're them. Now, notice that now I'm going to shift into sort of an interpersonal thing. Now, he does not ask them to get the belt. He does not take that approach. He said, we're going to have a conversation about a few things. Because of their honor, he doesn't want two things. First of all, that people should look at them as being a despicable people. So he starts off in a very much more elegant or indirect way. And also, what give me another reason why he may not want to open up in a much more soft, indirect manner. If you're going to talk about issues of criticizing or, reviewing past mistakes.
Anybody who's criticized puts up a wall.
Correct. The biggest challenge, if you have to talk to somebody about a mistake they made, it is extremely hard. You're likely to be unsuccessful because, as you said, because a person has a sense of self that I'm a good person. That is a prime directive. So therefore, that is a truth. That's a given. So if you say, you did this, their automatic says, what do you mean I did this? Oh, yeah, but you did this. Screw you. Right? So automatic will go on the attack to defend their sense of goodness. So the approach is not to take the approach of that they're bad. Take them as you're fantastic. And then indirectly bring in, but there was something that I felt that you may want to consider, do better, or maybe, or in a very indirect way, perhaps this you may have not intended this, but this came seemed to have been this consequence. In other words, if you're going to give a criticism, if you go the direct approach, it will be 100% unsuccessful, or not, except for a very special person who we'll talk about later, but. That's rare. So you cannot go direct for the emotion does not go right for the gullet. He doesn't go like, let me tell you about your parents. Let me tell you about what you're basically going to be like. Because basically they would basically turn around, they'd run away from the guy. They can't bear it. It'd be painful. It'd be painful. Okay. Then let me go to another one. We'll skip the second Rosh. I'm going to go to the third Rosh. He says, it came to pass in the 40th year in the 11th month and the first of the month. We already know that already, so why does it tell us that? Moshe spoke, this teacher that he rebuked him only a short time before his death. From whom did he learn this to do this? From Jacob, who rebuked his sons only a short time before his death. He said, Reuben, my son, I will tell you why I have not rebuked you, reproved you for your shortcomings during all these years, so that you would not leave and join my brother Esav. Okay, so let me just start with that. So strategically, how long was Moshe thinking about these issues?
40 years.
Right.
From the time of the act.
Yes. He had this speech in mind for 40 years. So first of all, the big challenge, by the way, that as a parent, or even, you know, or as a friend, even if you are correct, timing is everything. Just because you have a tremendous urge to tell them the truth about something, you have to find that right time where it will be heard. The Talmud says that the wise person only speaks when it will be heard. So he basically have sucked this in for 38 years. Now, how hard is it, if you have something really on your chest you want to share, to not verbalize that? How easy is that to keep that under wraps? Let's say you're really annoyed at a brother.
Right, he was Moses.
Right, okay. That's true. But in other words, let's say you have a brother, you have a wife, you have a sibling, and you really are angry at them. I mean, what do you want to do? And they were really, let's say it was a situation where it's unequivocally, they really messed up. What do you want to do?
You want to
unload on them. You want to nail them.
Sometimes it's easier not to say anything.
So that's true. So sometimes you don't want to. If a person is a person who wants to avoid conflict,
right,
and non-confrontational, then that's the other extreme. I never say anything. But
that's not healthy either.
That's also not healthy, and also not helping the other person.
Correct.
Right. So the sweet spot is to find
the
teachable moment. Mm-hmm. So what was a teachable moment?
He's gonna
die. Now, why is it the teachable moment?
Because they realize that they're not going to have him forever.
Yeah, but why are they mostly going to listen to him then? It's not just simply he's not going to be around, and also he has no other choice. If not now, when? That's also true. But why is that psychologically? I'm asking you, why is that?
Partly because people are not confrontational at that point. They said, you know, I'm not going to have him here much longer.
Right.
There's a finality to this.
Yes.
You know. Come 6 weeks from now, he's gone. I want to absorb all that I can from him because tomorrow I won't have it anymore.
Right, right, right. There is a openness, all the
honesty. That's true honesty.
Right, right. In other words, he has no agenda. It's over. This is it. What you're getting, that's it. He's doing it for you. The father is speaking to the child, says, this is it. This is a deathbed. This is a deathbed conversation. I'm sharing with you what I call the emes, the truth. This is it. It's not because I want you to be something or do something. There's no agenda. And the child feels that. And the drama of the deathbed or the near-death thing allows a psychological openness. And the defensiveness
drops
away. The window is open for a short time. Now, interesting, Moshe, Rashi says he got it from Jacob. Jacob did not, when Reuben did the thing with one of his concubines, Bilhah, he did not say anything then. And according to Rashi, why not? He said he didn't want him to join his uncle, Esav, who was not a good guy. So it's an interesting thing. Why would he have done that? Why would have Reuben done that?
Rebellious teenager.
Guilt.
He gets scolded by his father. He's going to run to the first person that's going to open their arms to him.
Right.
It would be Asa.
Right, right. So it says,
I'm going to get him.
Right. So
we'll get your father together. We'll teach him a lesson.
Right, exactly. In other words, see, Jacob and Asa are two brothers, but they also represent two civilizations. So if my dad tells me I'm a loser in this civilization,
I must be a winner in the other.
I'm going to go there. He's going to tell me how awesome I am. So I can endure the sense of being diminished in Jacob's house. But if I go to Esau's house,
I'll be a king.
I'll be a rock star. So therefore Yaakov knew that. So he said nothing. For years. For years. Which is tremendous self-control. Tremendous self-control.
Until Reuven was able to grow up, become a father, see the responsibilities, and absorb what his father had to tell him open-hearted.
On his deathbed. Yeah. He waited till literally a 2 hour before he's going to die. They all gather around. The scene in the end of Genesis is clear. Jacob's there, sitting on his bed. They're all gathering around. It's super dramatic. He shares his last will and testament, if you will, about the brothers, what they call the blessings. And he tells about, and the blessing, interestingly enough, to Reuven is not a blessing on the surface. It's the reality of what his situation. He says, "Cursed be your impetuousness," or so he. Which as many have explained, that actually is a blessing, because if you know your fundamental defect and you can work on that, you can turn that curse into a blessing. So it was a blessing because he got basically a lifetime of a psychoanalysis in 10 seconds. Boom. Transformed him. So Moshe, the same thing, also did the same thing. He waited. It's it. They're parked. They're at the border. They know he ain't going in with them. Joshua's already established as the next guy. He's waiting. You know, he's in the wings. He's on the on-deck circle. Okay? They know he's going to die. They're gathering around. This is his last thing. They're listening to what he has to say. And he does for the next 4 chapters talk about that. The last thing I want to end with, just as there's a statement in Proverbs, do not rebuke a scoffer, for he will hate you. Rebuke a wise man, and he will love you. A scoffer is not just a guy who likes to make jokes. A scoffer is actually a very sophisticated, smart guy. The Hebrew word is lates.
A wise ass.
Yes, that's better. That's a good translation. All right, but he's very sophisticated.
Right.
He's a smart guy.
Intelligent.
Right. The best examples of that, I'm not saying they are that way, but the late night comedians are particularly gifted in this way, you know, whether it be, Conan, you know, the capacity to deal with the crowd and, like, you know, deliver the zinger off the cuff and demolish people is a skill set, okay? And you got to be really quick on your feet. That's a scoffer. That's a late. In other words, they protect their identity and they maintain they're a wise person and they are free from any kind of defect, and their manner of that is not just simply denial but attack. Sure. In a way that you can't counter. Or the classic scene, like you're the classic scene of you're in a comedy club and then the comedian sees somebody on the front row. You don't ever want to be on the front row, okay? That's a rookie mistake. The guy's in the front row with the girl, and he doesn't realize that he is 5 minutes of material. And the comedian is not going to leave that opportunity alone. So he starts making, so you guys together, makes jokes, all kinds of stuff. You know, the guy's a little heavy, he makes fat jokes to the guy. And the guy who's not a trained comedian really cannot possibly, and also he does not have the mic. So he has multiple weaknesses going on there. So he's going to get nailed. That's a late. That guy if you tell any criticism, he'll hate you. He's perfect, he's wise, he's wonderful, he's fantastic. You're not getting through the guy. Waste of time. A wise person is a person that if you rebuke him, he'll love you. Why? Because you've improved me. I've been doing this particular thing wrong. I was unaware of this, and you pointed out to me. I'm indebted to you. I'm not going to anger you or anger you. You helped me. You're improving me. I thought about what you said, and I feel that you're on point. And I should love you because you helped me. Oh, did that initial pulling of the Band-Aid feel nice emotionally? No, it did not feel pleasant. It was unpleasant. But the bottom line is, I'm richer for it. I'm richer for it. So just to put everything into a nice little package is like this. I'm sharing with you basically two different concepts today. Concept number one is that all of our parents bequeathed us many good values. Some okay values, and there are certain things that are not good values. And if we don't think about that, we get the whole package: the good, the bad, the ugly. And what Moshe assumes is that the children of that generation is going to fall into the same trap. It's just a matter of time. It's going to happen. So the key thing is to try to, so what can you do about that? If you have a true friend who cares about you, who will you know, in a relatively nice way, show you what your shortcomings are, because you'll only improve. That person could, you know, should be your wife, you're, you know, a good person or a good friend. That's a good person who really helps you out. A friend who's not really a good friend, who wants to maintain the friendship, doesn't say anything because they want to maintain the relationship, they want to keep everything smooth. That's, you know, that's not really caring about the value of the other person. So that's point number one. Point number two is you see that how Moshe was so careful of to share the rebuke. He found, you know, a perfect moments. And people have very small teachable moments where the resistance is down and the teachable moment is up. And, you know, and you don't want to lose those own moments for your friends, and hopefully people feel the same way about you. And thirdly, of course, is that if somebody gives you rebuke, even in the wrong way, doesn't make it in the most egregious way. The truth is, if he's making a good point and the person's right, you should love that person because that person has objectively helped you. And that, you know, those are just a couple of walkways. So when you're dealing with kids, colleagues at work, your wife, your girlfriend, these are value-added things to do. And the key point I'm saying is that it's not easy to do that, but as far as rebuke, a wise person only says something when it will be heard. So when there are certain moments when people are open. And that's the basic idea. I want to share that. Thanks to my family.
Be receptive.
Good job, guys.
I'm receptive of whatever.